This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're going to learn more about a study being conducted by scientists from Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute that's monitoring algae levels in Lake Okeechobee by using a small, self-navigating sailboat drone. We'll talk with the study's principal investigator and the president of the company that built that vessel. But first, the U.S. is still struggling with opioid addiction, and Florida continues to experience some of the highest opioid overdose rates in the country. Last year, hospitals in Florida treated approximately 18,000 opioid overdoses. That's almost 50 every single day. Former Governor Rick Scott declared a public health emergency in May of 2017. And then last September, Florida was granted $27 million in federal funding to help fight the opioid crisis. That was part of a two-year, $54 million grant awarded to the state to pay for treatment, counseling, and medication to reverse drug overdoses. On today's show, we're joined by two guests to help us get a handle on how the public health emergency declaration and this new federal funding might be helping to curb the effects of the crisis and to take a look ahead to see what might happen during the 2019 legislative session in Florida. I'm joined in studio by Carrie Riedel. She is the Assistant Vice President of Outpatient Services at Salus Care in Fort Myers. Carrie, thanks for being here today.
Hi, Julie. Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined on the phone by Mark Fontaine. He is the Executive Director of the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. Mark, it's nice to talk to you as well.
Glad to be here.
And as always, we invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number to call to get involved is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Mark, I want to start with you. What has happened since that declaration of an emergency to address the issue?
Well, since the emergency, we've made the overdose drug naloxone more available, readily available across the state, the overdose reversal drug. And also we began the process of implementing the $27 million that the federal government made available to address the opioid epidemic. Most of those funds went directly to medication and treatment to community providers such as Salus Care across the state to serve people with an overdose or with an opioid use disorder.
So the declaration, what does it do exactly on the state level? Does it free up the ability to put some things in place? Does it free up dollars on the state level?
So the state does not have the ability to spend resources unless they're allocated by the legislature. By the governor making the declaration, he allowed the resources from the federal government to be spent 2 months earlier than the state budget. They had already been authorized by the legislature, but he allowed the funds to be spent. And then the second thing it did is it made the prescription, the naloxone, to be made available to individuals that walk into a pharmacy and say, I need that. Traditionally, you'd have to go to your doctor to get a prescription to take to the pharmacy. Now you could go to the pharmacy, and if you were concerned about an opioid overdose, you could go get that medication.
Does insurance cover something like that?
The insurance covers there's a lot of different insurance plans, and some do, and some cover part of that medication.
Yeah, and so that's a drug that somebody can go and get their hands on now at a pharmacy that is something that reverses an overdose?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the recently, and I forget which federal government organization it was, but was recommending that certain individuals getting opioid prescriptions should also get a prescription for naloxone in case there was a concern of an overdose.
I'm guessing that wouldn't be like, you know, Joe Blow who had knee surgery and needs something for a short period of time. These are people that are repeatedly being prescribed.
There'd be people that would be at risk.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So would you say, though, that you feel like we're making some progress in the fight against opioids here in Florida?
Well, if you look at the opioid caused deaths in 2015, there were 2535 in Florida, 2535. In 2017, there was 4279. The 18 data is not readily available. This is the data from the coroners, and it won't be available for a while. What we are doing is we're making a lot of progress on people beginning to understand the epidemic and beginning to approach more effective strategies for addressing the epidemic. The legislature last year in House Bill 21 that was sponsored by Senator Liz Beth Mancuso, your senator, the legislature addressed the prescription drug monitoring program, the pain clinics, the number of the number of pills that could be made available, dispensing requirements, et cetera. So I think we're putting a lot of the pieces in place to address the epidemic, yes.
I'm surprised that there isn't more information readily available. 2018 numbers aren't in. We're almost through February, and there, I mean, you got 67 county coroners. Is there any kind of a clearinghouse of information where this type of stuff is being reported, or is that part of some of the projects that are being put together to get a handle on this epidemic?
Well, one of the things that that we've found, at least in this epidemic, is there's no place in Florida where we're pulling all of this data together readily and with some urgency to try to utilize it to do trending and trend data. Some of that used to happen when we had an Office of Drug Control Policy, which we don't have anymore in Florida. So the Department of Children and Families and the Department of Health have stepped up and have been making some efforts at trying to address those data needs.
Just
so we're working on that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be good to have the information to know what you're dealing with to figure out how to deal with it. So tell me a little bit about the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association, which is what you work with.
So the association is a statewide organization that represents community providers, agencies like Salus Care across the state from Pensacola to Key West that provide prevention, treatment, and intervention services and recovery services to individuals with a substance use disorder. And we just combined with the Mental Health Association, so now we're treating the whole individual, mental health and substance use.
And that was something that I remember we were reporting a lot about, the instead of simply funding medication and ways to medically get people off of opioids, that other, the mental health component. How important do you feel like that part is to actually addressing the opioid epidemic? Because, I mean, giving somebody the drugs to make them not want to have the drugs anymore doesn't fix the economic pressures and the addictive personalities and things.
So the funds we're using from the federal government and the funds that were already committed from the state, it's the entire package. It's the medication to stabilize the brain and also the counseling and wraparound services to help these individuals find a pathway to recovery.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to turn now in studio, Carrie Riedel. What have you been seeing at Salus Care here on the local level? Have things gotten any better?
Well, we have the services now to help people who are struggling with opioid addiction. So some of the funding that Mark is talking about has come to Salus Care, and we have developed a program. We've been working with Vivitrol, which is an opioid blocker, for about a year and a half, and we just recently introduced Suboxone, which is a partial antagonist to help with opioid addiction.
So, yeah, I remember doing stories about that particular once-a-month drug. How much success have you seen with that? Does that make it easier to sit down and deal with all the other issues that accompany addiction?
Absolutely. So if your brain isn't constantly considering and thinking about how you'll get your drugs and how you'll get your alcohol, you're able to focus and kind of move your life forward and think about the other things that it takes to really find recovery and find sobriety.
So this particular medication, it works for things other than opioids?
Opioids and alcohol addiction.
Wow, so it takes an alcoholic and makes them not crave alcohol anymore.
The medication is known to do that, yes.
That's pretty remarkable. I mean, a lot of people, though, I remember when this first came out, people kind of felt like it might be the silver bullet. This is the thing. This is what we've got. How hard was it, though, to get people to realize once you can't be on that forever, can you?
You theoretically can. Most people are not, but you can. And for most people, 6 to 8 months is an average time frame that they're using the medication. But people can be on longer because what we really want to do is prevent relapse. So we're helping curb cravings. And in addition to providing medication, we're doing all the other ancillary things that Mark mentioned. We are providing therapy in a group and an individual type setting. We are helping people with housing and employment and basic needs, you know, those things that, you know, cause people to go back out to use substances when they're not taken care of.
Exactly. How many of your patients are there because of opioids? I mean, what percent breakdown would you give it, ballpark? I mean, I'm not asking for specific numbers.
Many people are dealing with multiple types of substances. So very few are coming and saying, I've only ever used this substance over here. Most people, it's kind of a mix of substances that they've used over their using career.
I'm wondering if you're seeing more or less of people who have gone from opioids into a heroin or fentanyl situation.
Absolutely.
Are you seeing more people doing that?
Absolutely.
Is it because of the inability to just get the pills anymore?
I think that's a big part of it. So we've made headway with the prescribing physicians in the area and in the state and nationally that we're, you know, limiting painkiller type medications. But yes, it's, you know, what we see is then people aren't able to obtain that. They switch over to heroin, which unfortunately is affordable and attainable.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, I mean, so it's well-intentioned to limit the number of opioids that doctors give people. It is, okay, well, if people are getting addicted and they're having a problem with opioids, let's not let – that's a controlled substance that we can actually control. Well, there are other controlled substances that we can't control. Like you mentioned, they're cheaper, like heroin. Is limiting the ability of doctors to prescribe these pills – putting more people into a heroin situation?
I think it's just going to help people not get addicted in the first place.
Okay. All right. I was just curious about that. I don't want to push people into a street drug, especially fentanyl, which scares me every time I even say the word.
It's scary to us as well. And generally, it's not a drug that people are using on its own. It's that it's sort of laced into other substances that they're using, that they're finding.
Mark, I wanted to ask you, what's the statewide perspective on the breakdown between prescription opioids versus heroin and fentanyl? Are you seeing more prescription opioids or more people going to heroin and fentanyl?
Well, what we're seeing is that the deaths are generally being caused by fentanyl, and that's where we have this incredible spike in deaths in Lee County. In 2015, there were 85 opioid-caused deaths. In 2017, there were 203. So that's as Carrie said, the information, when you're getting the drugs on the street, you're not sure what those drugs are, you know, what they've been laced with. And that's what makes the fentanyl incredibly dangerous.
Where is this coming from, fentanyl?
China. It's a factory produced in China generally.
We've done entire segments just on fentanyl and its extremely dangerous nature. Are more and more people going to that, or are people hearing how dangerous it is and not going there?
That's a tough question to answer because it has a lot to do with what's available in a given community at any given time. If you have people that are addicted, then they're going to pursue what's available on the street. And fentanyl may or may not be in that heroin that is on the street, or really in any of those other drugs. Starting to see cocaine laced with fentanyl, even methamphetamine. So, it's a difficult question to answer.
It's a hard thing to even track. I'm wondering, Carrie, how psychologically does it impact an addict when they go to street drugs? Because when people who become addicted to opioids, we've talked to a number of them here in the studio. There are people who've had, you know, a surgery or a thing or a pain thing or an arthritis situation that were given opioids by their doctor. They took the opioids because they were told that this is going to make your pain not so bad. And it ended up becoming a situation of addiction. So these are, you know, people next door. These are not – we're not talking about a stereotypical drug user that ends up becoming addicted to opioids. So once somebody is addicted to opioids and they come from a background that would not naturally be the, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Not like the Skid Row stereotype.
Right.
So when they go from having taken opioids and then having this addiction, and then when that's taken away from them, and then they go to street stuff, is it psychologically even more difficult for them to come back, or do they recognize that, or are they so in their addiction that they don't see the difference?
Yeah. Opioid addiction doesn't discriminate. And like you said, you know, what we might have in the past seen as the, as you framed it, Skid Row.
But you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. It just doesn't discriminate. We're seeing it in all ages, all demographics, all, you know, socioeconomic classes. It's happening everywhere. And you're right. It very often starts as a very innocent, you know, I had a surgery and I need to control my pain kind of situation. And then when those drugs are no longer available, the brain chemistry has changed. Right. So your brain now is seeking that medication. So it's not just behavioral, but it's physical as well.
And I think a lot of people that have not been afflicted with addiction personally have a hard time understanding that this is not a matter of will and that it's a chemical brain situation that's causing this behavior.
Absolutely.
Some people kind of say, well, suck it up and be strong. And you can't do that when your brain has been altered.
Right. Right.
The opioid epidemic has changed a lot of that conversation because in the opioid epidemic, the swath of who's affected is really everybody. So it's kind of hard to find people nowadays that can truly say, I don't know anybody that hasn't been affected.
That is true. Maybe this has changed the conversation about addiction, too, in the country. You know, like you say, Mark.
It certainly is opening up the conversation. I mean, you think about the last 2 years, almost every day you open a newspaper, you watch the news, you read a magazine, and there's a story. Go to the bookstore and look at the titles of the books, and you just see a lot more being written, reported, and talked about related to addiction.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Carrie Riedel. She's the Assistant Vice President of Outpatient Services at Salus Care in Fort Myers. And I'm also talking with Mark Fontaine. He's the Executive Director of the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. We're getting an update on efforts to combat the opioid epidemic here in Florida. Have you or someone you love been impacted by opioid addiction? If so, we'd really like to hear your story. So join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Mark, tell me a little bit more about this federal grant and what it's intended for and how it's being distributed. Because from what I understand, when there's a grant that comes from a given place, there are earmarks on it, like it needs to be used for this or this. How many limitations are on that federal money?
So the state back in October received received $50 million, just over $50 million, in what's called now State Opioid Response Grant, and that grant theoretically, hopefully, will be for 2 years. It has a few requirements on it. Essentially, it's used for individuals with an opioid use disorder, so it's limited to individuals with an opioid use disorder. And there's some requirements on data reporting, there's a GIPR interview, which is a face-to-face interview that tracks progress made at intervals. But other than that, it is up to the state to utilize those funds as it seems appropriate to address making those funds available to the communities to address the opioid epidemic. And the Department of Children and Families has done a good job getting that money out through the managing entities to the communities. But one of the things we're finding is that service capacity is not endless. I mean, these funds get, we serve 10,000 people in the first year of the grant. So the resources go pretty quick, especially buying medications and maintaining people on medications over time.
Yeah.
One of the difficult things is you're funding health care with a grant, which always makes it incredibly difficult.
Well, the nature of grants is they end.
Yes.
And the opioid epidemic has no foreseeable end, really.
Absolutely.
And this is a two-year grant of $54 million, correct?
Yes.
$50 million a year for the next 2 years, this year and next year. So it started as a $27 million grant that was 2 years, so that's your 54, and then we just got the second version of this, which is a state opioid response grant, which Congress agreed to last March, I think, and that money was available in October.
So the money's coming here, and it's and you're saying that it's helping to fund a lot in the way of medications, medicated-assisted treatments.
Right.
We talked briefly about Vivitrol. That's the one that people can take once a month, and it can make your brain stop thinking that the only thing in the world that matters is getting more of the thing that you're addicted to. How do people get that Vivitrol? Are they able to get it, just walk up at a pharmacy, like you mentioned, for the one that's specific for overdoses?
Well, the funds that the state has and that are available through this grant are for a targeted audience, people that are approaching a community provider and essentially don't have the resources to purchase that drug themselves, or are that are involved in the justice system. Some of this funding comes through the Office of State Courts Administration, and it's for people that are involved or at high risk of being involved in the justice system. And then it's made available to the community providers. There was 6,062 shots that have been given with that medication since we began the last 2 years.
And Carrie, what if somebody kind of comes to their own realization they have a problem, mm-hmm. and they are addicted to opioids and they'd like to get a hold of some Vivitrol? How do they do that?
Definitely, that's where Salus Care comes in. So you just give us a call. The easiest way to call us is our main phone number, 239-275-3222. We offer Vivitrol. As Mark mentioned, we make it available for folks who maybe don't think they can afford it or cannot afford it on their own. It is still a little bit of a pricey medication, and so we're really grateful to have some of the funding that FATA has provided to our agency to help patients in need.
What does it cost?
If a person were to buy it outright, it would be somewhere in the $1,000 range.
A month?
Mm-hmm. And it is covered by insurances. So many insurance companies are seeing the value in treating opioid addiction, which is great. And then we're also working with this grant funding that's been super helpful for patients.
But Vivitrol itself, it doesn't make people feel like they're high.
No, absolutely not.
Right. I just wanted to make sure, because from what I understand, methadone, does methadone have that kind of an impact?
It can for some, depending on the dosage. So for Vivitrol, if you picture receptors inside the brain, mm-hmm. what the Vivitrol does is there's an opioid receptors, and the Vivitrol sits on those opioid receptors. So it works in a couple of ways. One, if I were to use and I have Vivitrol on board already sitting in those receptors, I'm not going to get high. So I'm not going to feel that euphoria that the medication would have given me.
Mm-hmm.
From the opioid, from the addict's perspective, why would I use? would I bother to use? Because I'm not going to get the feeling that I'm looking for. And then the second effect is that it blocks craving. So if I know that I'm not going to get high and I'm not feeling cravings like I want to get high all the time, that's how the medications work.
What kind of a withdrawal situation are people dealing with then?
For Vivitrol, you have to be fully free of opioids.
So you got to go through the opioid withdrawal. How long does that take?
It depends. It depends on the person. It depends on what types of medications they were taking, what types of street drugs they were taking. But it's not comfortable, and we definitely recommend to people that they go through a detox program so that they can be medically monitored and medical people can help them through that process.
Okay, so somebody going in thinking, I'm just going to cold turkey it and then take Vivitrol when I get through it.
People do it.
Really?
It's not impossible, but it's definitely not what we recommend. We have services for that. You know, misery is optional. And it's not going to be comfortable, but it's not going to be dangerous either. When you're in a medical setting, we can track and monitor how you're doing, what's going on, give you some comfort medications. So definitely a detox protocol is better.
And I'm wondering, the reason I ask these questions is because I'm kind of thinking of the older person, the older addict, maybe an older gentleman or woman who, you know, has gone through a lot and has, you know, maybe some arthritic pain, ended up getting addicted to opioids and may want to tough it out a little bit more just because of a generational difference. Of course, I'm totally generalizing here. But you know what I'm saying? That kind of – that type of – person, too embarrassed to say that it's actually a problem or that mm-hmm. they have an addiction problem. I mean, those – I would imagine you encounter people like those.
Absolutely. And we can help them just the same.
Yeah.
You know, and we're always careful with people's confidentiality and what they're dealing with and going through. And so we can help them through that process.
I think there are people that may still believe that once you have a prescription for something, it then goes on your permanent health record and you will forever be stamped as such, you know, and there might be a fear of that in people's lives, you know, especially older people that have some pride.
That is the stigma that we all face as people try to deal with either their mental illness or their addiction. And thankful that there's so much conversation that I think some people are beginning to understand that the more you talk about that, the more the stigma goes away and the more it becomes mainstream part of the human condition and you deal with it like you do with any other medical condition that you're dealing with.
Mark, I wanted to ask you, do you foresee anything happening during the 2019 legislative session that would have an impact on Florida's opioid situation?
Well, I think they will continue to authorize the allocation of these funds. I am anticipating they will continue to fund the medications that the Florida legislature is also funding. I think they'll be looking at House Bill 21 and how that is working out and whether there needs to be any tweaks to that. But we've had legislation the last 2 years, so my sense is there may be a more of a let's wait and see how we're doing overall as we go into this session.
And Mark, I want to ask you one last question before we run out of time. But if you could write legislation that could help with this fight and ensure its passage, what would it be? What kind of legislation would you like to see the state adopt?
Two things. I would like to not have a funding cliff. I'd like this medication to be medications and services to be part of everybody's health care package, whether that be a Medicaid insurance, however you get health care, that this would be a common practice. And I think the second thing is that we would honestly, truly have a public conversation about stigma and put it aside once and for all so that people can get the care they need.
Carrie, you're over here emphatically nodding your head, especially with point number one. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's insurance. It's important that insurances cover this medication because it is just like any other medication you would take for a chronic relapsing medical condition. You might take a medication for diabetes or you might take a medication for MS. It's the same
heart disease, yeah.
Chronic relapsing condition. So I agree with Mark. We've got to have that conversation and we've got to decrease that stigma to the point where people can talk about it as if they would talk about diabetes or heart conditions. But the second part is that there are so many of our patients that come to us with no insurance. So having insurance cover it is absolutely essential, but also having funding out there to cover the people who don't have insurance is key too. So thanks to Mark for that.
All right. Well, that's all the time that we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Carrie Riedel. She is the Assistant Vice President of Outpatient Services at Salus Care in Fort Myers. Carrie, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also Mark Fontaine, the Executive Director of the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. Mark, thanks so much to you as well.
I was good to be with you. Thank you.
When we return, we're going to learn about an innovative new study of algae in Lake Okeechobee using an automated self-sailing drone that collects data about algae levels that researchers can monitor in real time. We're joined by the principal investigator from Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute and the president of NavOcean, which built the solar-powered research vessel, to learn more. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.